is The Liminalist, the podcast between. It's Jason Halsey. This week I'm talking to Joseph Domenech. That's a pseudonym. He's a Los Angeles-based screenwriter. And we're talking about Hollywood. The quality of the audio at Joseph's end was not good. It does improve after about half an hour, so hang in there. Hopefully it will be more or less audible. And what's your impression of the circle that you do hang out with, the people that you do know there, in terms of how credible they find this kind of perspective, that actually Hollywood isn't what it appears to be, and it's not just about there are some really nasty people out there abusing their power, but there's something endemic to the system that the power abuse and the exploitation is inseparable from it, and it's almost like levels of initiation. That's what you're touching on or hinting at there. Is that a perspective? I mean, clearly that perspective is quite, I mean, you and I are talking, we didn't connect over script writing, or we didn't find each other because we're interested in script writing and movies so much as we're interested in the dark stuff. But what's about the people that you do hang out with there who aren't necessarily into conspiracy culture, or maybe they are, I don't know, but how many people do you find who are open to this without actually knowing about it for sure, without having been able to confirm it?
I think that it's a matter of perspective. I remember this one actress who became a friend of mine, and you know, was dating a friend of mine, whatever. I remember talking to her very early on in my career, like second movie I ever worked on. And she told me, you know, we're talking about not quite this level sort of conspiracy, but just the industry, maybe sort of like more Me Too type of stuff. And she told me that, you know, she'll go into a meeting with a casting director, a nobody, you know, obviously has control and power over people simply by being able to get the money and make their careers and so on. Not major. I'm not talking about, you know, Spider-Man in cast as Spider-Man. I'm talking about like a TV show, minor role, where he literally said, mm-hmm. with me, I'll give you the role. Just like mm-hmm. as if I was asking for a piece of gum, you know, like just totally casual, the most normal thing you can imagine. And so, well, what would you see that as? On the surface level, literally in an actual official meeting, you know, this business, that level of just casual, transactional exploitation, what's that? I mean, you know, so it's like, yeah, maybe that girl I'm referring to, maybe she wouldn't be, you know, reading, you know, Strange Things Inside Laurel Canyon and thinking, oh yeah, this is going on, but isn't that what it's talking about really? Ultimately, maybe in darker terms and in darker circumstances, but what's really so different about it? If that's what's going on in the, you know, in the offices of the studios, so
in a way that is so normalized, you mean, like there's no shiftiness about it, there's just this assumption that this is, or this understanding even, that this is how it works here. And of course that would signal to the actress or whoever in question right from the start that if she reacts badly or she's shocked or that she's being naive and she doesn't realize how it works, and so there's no point in going out there and getting indignant and talking to people about it because, hey, welcome to the real world kind of attitude. Yeah?
That's not going to get you anywhere, certainly. You know, talking about it and complaining about it, I don't think that would be a really ticket to the top, certainly. But I think my question would be, well, what is the conspiracy for people to sort of buy into, right? I mean, for example, the way that the military and the CIA are wrapped up with the industry, that's not, is that a conspiracy? I mean, it happens right there. I mean, there, these people are working with them. It's the, you know, the Air Force is showing up for Captain Marvel, you know, so that's not, everybody knows that's happening. Now, you and I and other people sympathetic to our beliefs, I suppose, maybe would look at it differently, have a different perspective on that, but it's not really willing to believe or not to believe. They're right there sponsoring these movies that are, you know, painting the military and the police and whoever else in a positive light. So that's a, maybe a more, a dark, they're trying to glorify the CIA. Well, that's just a fact right there in the open. The casting couch thing, that didn't come up out of nowhere. That's not a conspiracy. That's what happens. Everybody knows that, even if you're not in the industry. So that's what I would kind of ask is like, what is the revealing and what is the level at which you would become that believes in the conspiracy? And yeah, I mean, everybody knew what Harvey Weinstein was up from what I can tell, what he was up to, and everyone's up to that, right? I mean, who isn't doing that shit? So, you know, it's an interesting question about how many people, you know, I work with that are sympathetic to that. I think they're probably a little more optimistic about the virtues of the industry, you know, like when they cast, you know, a gay person as a superhero or whatever, well, that means they're good, right? That means that Disney's good. They have a, you know, person of color as the new Disney princess. So they can look past these bad things and write them off as just natural parts of the process and some bad apples that you just have to deal with another added optimism of, oh, well, now we're getting rid of them because of Me Too. Oh, well, they'll all be gone now because of Me Too. So I don't know, it's an interesting question, but people are definitely aware of the dark nature, even younger people, I think.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the things I'd look at with 60 Maps of Hell is how conspiratainment is coming, you know, this phenomenon whereby this potentially becomes another layer of the entertainment of it all, like is Katy Perry in the Illuminati? I mean, nobody's... Somehow it doesn't have any real... Even though it's in the same... It's in the same continuum with is Harvey Weinstein raping, you know, young women, or is Bryan Singer raping young boys? These really overtly horrific things, a part of the same continuum of is Katy Perry and the Illuminati, really, because, I mean, if there's anything to that at all, if there is a secret society aspect, if there are initiation rituals and so on, and I think there are, whether they're in Hollywood or not, they certainly exist. But one is entertainment and the other is, it's still clickbait, but it's more the kind of outrage, the entertainment of outrage. Oh, that's so terrible, you know. What I'm seeing is a weird kind of way. It's a bit like coming out of the closet. So there's a way that the information gets managed, so which is off-gassing. I mean, it's coming out anyway, so then manage the way it comes out. I mean, the Kevin Spacey thing, for example, he did that video where he pretended to be Frank from House of Games. I mean, what the fuck was that? Right?
Yeah.
It was turning something dark and disturbing into this kind of weird meta entertainment.
Well, people think that was like one of these public signals. I've heard relatively mainstream, I guess, conspiracy, if you want to call them that, thinkers, whatever, a certain podcast I listened to. He was holding like a commemorative mug from like the Queen of England. I think it was like from her, like, I don't know, some event where there was like a certain mug, and he was holding that in that video. So there's people that think that specifically was, you know, like a signaling to these forces that to help him maybe or something like that. And then one of his accusers ended up dying. That's not really proof of anything certainly, but it's definitely strange. And that video was like, why would you do that? There's absolutely no reason. If you were a functioning, relatively sane person, there's absolutely no explanation of why you would do something like that, other than some nefarious purpose. I don't know.
If you were in a sane culture, one might want to add to that as well, because. And I think it is fair to point out that after that video, I mean, I don't want to make it causative, but since then, Spacey, the charges have all been dropped, partly due to one of the victims dying, right? So whatever happened, that video didn't screw things up for him, right? But there is another way of looking at the motive for that video, which I consider, which is appealing to his fan base also, to say, look, whatever you're hearing about me, I'm still the Kevin Spacey that you love, and you love me for playing an evil character, so why not love me if you think I'm really evil? And that, I mean, that's quite sophisticated kind of psychological thing, and it's not incompatible with the other thing. I mean, there could be various, because that's also a kind of leverage, like Kevin Spacey signaling, look, you can try and hang me out to dry, but I can directly appeal to my fan base, and there's a kind of power in that too. So there's a number of things going on there that we're just seeing, you know, the outside. We're seeing it from the outside, so we've got to kind of deduce and speculate.
And we're seeing what they want us to see, which is obviously always going to be inherently, you know, a misdirection of some kind, or there's certainly something underneath that to be uncovered, or they don't want us to see. I think that what I think has a more negative effect on people's perception of these things, I think that the conspiratainment, the Alex Jones of the world, the crazy lizard people, Illuminati stuff, I think that does do damage, because, you know, once you start going on one of these threads with people who aren't educated about these things, well, then their minds instantly goes to that. So I do think that plays a part in it. But I think one of the bigger things is the sort of like limited hangouts that they have. I think that the Me Too movement was sort of like a limited hangout, where, okay, now this is what's going on. We're exposing it. It's finally the day where all these people are going to be exposed for all they're doing. And look at how dark and incredibly dark this is that Harvey Weinstein was doing, and Matt Lauer and whoever else, Charlie Rose. And let's all fight for that and do hashtag Me Too. And we're going to get these guys out of here, and we're going to make it a safe place for women to come forward. And no women are ever going to be exploited again. In reality, what they're doing was a million times worse than any of the accusations. Like, if you think that the worst things Harvey Weinstein's ever done was, you know, attempt, and these are obviously horrible crimes on themselves, I definitely don't mean to minimize them at all, but if you think the worst thing he's ever done was, you know, attempt to, you know, rape, sexually assault famous actresses, well, then you're pretty fucking naive. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I'm sure no question that there's high level international thing going on in the industry, you know, people being passed, like, not just people, but stars, I think. So I think that does a lot of damage to it, where you think the evil has been exposed. And so you can kind of hang your hat on that and say, well, now this problem is being solved. And they didn't really even expose all the shit that was really going on. I mean, like, what Bryan Singer was doing, I mean, come on. Like, we're talking about prolific pedophilia, like right there, massive, like in the most sick ways you can even think of. And because like a little of it gets exposed, oh, there was this boy I said he worked on one time. Oh, that's what he was up to. You know, he just, a couple things. You don't look deeper into it and realize like there's probably hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of victims from all these creeps. I think that does a lot of damage as well.
So using Singer as an example, is there a slightly different scuttlebutt there where you are, where you're not working with insiders, but you're working with half inside who've worked with insiders. So presumably there is more, there's more first-hand, there's going to be rumors that are sourced in first-hand testimonies and stuff. So would you say the attitude to someone like Bryan Singer is subtly different there? As in, yeah, of course everybody knows you're doing. Have you got that sense when his name comes up?
Well, it's kind of darkly funny, but I remember one time, it was the Oscars where his movie about Queen was nominated. And this guy that I've been writing work, I've been texting him about it. And I said something like, oh, did you see Bohemian Rhapsody? And he said, yeah, I feel bad for Brian. I just like didn't even like figure out what he meant by that, whether he knew, but I don't know. He's not like a powerful person like that, certainly. He's not powerful at all. So I don't know what he meant by that, but I just thought that was just it was almost like so darkly funny that that's what you would take away from that happening. For both of you, you feel bad for Bryan Singer. But I don't know if it's something that's spoken about. I think people, they don't really know. Really, how could you know unless you've been there at these parties they were throwing? And if you don't know, he's a guy that committed a few sexual assaults. Maybe the kids were slightly underage. I've known people that have done that. You've known people that have done that. Those people are in the industry. What's really to look into there or even think about? The guy's career has been, I guess, ended, I suppose, hopefully. So what? Why would somebody spend their time in industry, time and energy digging into this dark stuff to upset themselves? Like, I don't know, why would they invest that unless they were, the curious minds, I suppose, like you and I might be, and other people. So it's just, I don't get a sense of like people really interested in digging into these things.
Sure, but people love to gossip. So you say, how would you know unless you'd been there? Well, but obviously loads of people were at those parties. I mean, thousands of people. So you would think that, I mean, you no doubt, even I no doubt, would know somebody who knew somebody who was at those parties, right? But it's not as though there's a great deal of talk about them.
You think about David Geffen. I mean, there was like a news story about, Barack Obama being on his boat. You know what I mean? Like, so how really in the open could these things even be? Even in sort of gossiping circles, if this guy is one of the most powerful people in the world, as the adoration of every billionaire and millionaire and powerful person, and if it is, then well, that tells you all you need to know about what's going on and how normalized it is. But I haven't heard any personal sort of gossip about that. These things also were happening, I guess, the Bryan Singer Geffen parties that were associated with that like video company that they were a part of. That was like sort of that whole scandal. I think that was before my time, I guess, in the industry. So
the Den, D-E-N. You're talking about Den, yeah, the Gary Goddard, the thing Gary Goddard was. Yeah, I think that's probably what you mean. You brought up Geffen a couple of times now, and then with Singer, of course. So the gay mafia is the thing that, I mean, I've got a chapter in the book about the gay mafia, and it's, there isn't much you can find out about it. Is that something that you heard about in LA? Is that a phrase you ever hear, the gay mafia?
No, I haven't heard anything like that myself in my time. If people are referencing it or whatever. But, I mean, it's out there. I mean, I've read stories about these, like, factions of this hierarchy of, I guess, the gay community and how they, trade boys and young actors and child actors and so on. And people have read stories about that. But nothing that I hear about personally, though you can definitely feel sort of the presence around, West Hollywood obviously is a hub of a lot of different stuff, and that's known as a gay community, for better or for worse, I suppose, in this case. So, nothing that I've heard too much about myself.
Mike Ovitz, when he came down, he went on record as blaming the gay mafia. Did you hear that?
No.
Yeah, he got roasted. And Geffen was one of the... I mean, he and Mike Ovitz and Geffen were mortal foes, and it ended up with Geffen going out on a limb by blaming the gay mafia, and then of course it being denied, and then him being publicly exposed, or, accused of homophobia and sheer lunacy over that.
Right. I mean, it's happening, certainly. I actually recently, I have some friends who are, I'm friends with a family in the entertainment industry. And from one of the kids who's like a teenage, actor, social media, like celebrity type of person, told me about a strange encounter that they had are you familiar with, obviously you're familiar with social media celebrities, I'm sure, but there's a new trend popping up, which I think you might find interesting, where they take these social media celebrities, these teenagers and early 20s people, and they put them in a house that's paid for by an agency. So the agency pays for the house, and either an agency or some other mysterious entity, commonly agency management company. And the kids live in the house, no parents. I mean, some of them are over 18, and I think maybe most of them are, but still 18, 19 years old, standard model actor types. So they live in this house, no supervision. I'm sure they're, given any number of drugs, from what I've heard personally, and then just from what you can assume. They make content, or they make social media content, monetized social media content. They have quotas they have to meet to afford their rent, I suppose, in these houses that they live in amongst these other kids. And I looked into it and found that these one company in particular had heavy, heavy ties to the United States government. It's kind of a long, complicated story, but I also heard about some very creepy things going on there with older people getting involved in stuff there, the kids being invited out to dinner with very wealthy people, the handlers, I suppose, like I said, being heavily connected to the United States government. One of them, he's actually a 21-year-old, so he's the head of talent for one of these companies, right? The people that he is an agent for, these kids, they have tens of millions of followers, like big time stuff. The same time this management company got started, that ended up owning one of these houses and bringing all these kids in under their control, he had started a cryptocurrency venture with a Heritage Foundation Cato Institute Trump advisor guy in the same time period last fall, with a very strange company. And like I said, this 21-year-old who's a talent agent controlling millions and millions of dollars, so much money this guy is in control of, and very, very famous people, and had in the past worked on Donald Trump's campaign and had meetings with senators and meetings with the president, and a very, very strange background. And I heard that there had been, that he and the guys that he sort of works for and with have been very closely fraternizing, let's say, with these kids. And he actually had, so I don't know how much you buy into this stuff, but I don't know how much myself, but he had like Pizzagate terminology on his like social media accounts. And said he worked at the pizza store. So sorry, that was kind of a long-winded thing. But I thought that it was relevant to the sort of David Geffen thing. My point is, I can see from this situation, watching as the new generation of the David Geffens are formed in this new media space where there aren't even any unions. There aren't even any parents. There's nothing, there's no regulatory bodies of any kind. There's no oversight. These kids are pumping out content, meeting quotas just to live in this house where there's no supervision. And from what I can tell, and I don't want to, make any definitive statements, it seems like there's being trafficked and passed around amongst these types of people. So I can already see in this new world how it's forming. It's even easier. It's even better for these people. Yeah. Mm.
So presumably many of these social media celebrities at this YouTube, they're filming themselves as part of their output, presumably.
Yes, yes. Posting pictures of themselves constantly. This one house I've been looking into in particular, all the photos were all the guys that were like very young men, but they were like 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old boys, I suppose.
Twinks in the vernacular.
Sure. Always touching each other. These aren't like, as far as I can tell, there's no gay, they're not like gay guys or anything. They're like supposed to be attracting, young women, sort of boy music group way, always to each other, kissing each other, very close, no shirts on, showing off their tattoo, showing off their body, in the pool, hugging, always touching each other. It seems to me like a menu. You know what I mean? I just don't know how else you can look at it, knowing the kind of things that we know about the industry. So I know that that's sort of very vague information, but I think you can kind of see the threads and the similarities between the more commonly known things like the Geffens of the world and I suppose the Jeffrey Epsteins and all across the board.
Seeing as there was a natural break there, do you want to recount your experiences with Tom Sizemore? Is there anything around that that you think is worth sharing?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely, you know, this, I guess my specific encounters with him aren't necessarily as interesting, but I think that, you know, he definitely had a certain gravitas, as I mentioned to you over email, that, you know, like I said, it at first you think it's by nature of just like him having been around these big names, you know, learned about acting from Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and worked with Michael Mann and Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks and all these, you know, Johnny Depp, and just been in those circles and just known what it's like and felt that energy. I think that gravitas. But when you think about these things more critically and you look more deeply at them, as I have been more recently in my life, you think about the fact that he dated a Heidi Fleiss, you know, God only knows the things those two have seen, particularly Heidi. I mean, if anybody knows, you know, what really goes on in this fucking world, I'm sure it would be her. And, you know, he had sort of he's obviously not a great person. He's obviously done some fucked up things in his life, any number of things. I certainly don't want to endorse him morally, but there is certainly a sadness about him, a quality of a life that had been lost, and even wasted, I suppose, and a full knowledge of that almost like he looked in the mirror and saw a beast when he woke up in the morning, you know, partially of his own doing as well. But I don't think you can discount the effect that simply being in this entertainment industry at that level would affect you. And he kind of is a person who, as you can see, his mind clearly broke. I'm sure he wasn't seeing any sort of darker things than the average whatever person that's around A-lister sees, but for some reason he had broken, and in that break seems to have achieved I don't know if clarity is the right word, but at least you can see it in him, the sort of shit he's seen, mm-hmm. type of thing. You know, you kind of can see that in him. He wasn't, you know, in the mansion or the penthouse and on the red carpets with makeup on and the hairstylist and the handlers and the PR. He was right there bare for anybody to see. And looking back on it with the sort of context I understand now, that has a much weightier, that represents something a lot heavier to me than I had previously thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is quite speculative, but he even played that role in Natural Born Killers. It was really, you know, just such a sick and depraved character in that film, which was all sick and depraved characters. So he's kind of like, I think what you're suggesting is that even the very fact that he seems more brutal and monstrous on the surface may suggest that he's more sensitive and less able to function as a fully functioning sociopath within that community, where being a really effective as a sociopath, as I say, this is speculative, but at a certain point we kind of have to speculate to make sense of it. Somebody like George Clooney or Ben Affleck or Matt Damon, all of whom backed up Harvey Weinstein and no doubt knew the worst of it, probably mm-hmm. the worst of it, but certainly a hell of a lot more than they copped to. They seem like good guys, whereas Tom Sizemore seems like a bad guy. So that does suggest a kind of inversion there, whereby which would make scapegoating very easy, as in, you know, the sensitive ones are also the weak links, the ones who are likely to break and spill the beans and whatnot, but they're also the kind who kind of show the depravity the most clearly on the surface, so they're the easiest to make them walk the plank or to, you know, parade before the public. This is what a monster looks like.
Right. And I think whether that speaks to his personal morality, I don't know. That's not quite what I'm implying, as much as mm-hmm. simply by nature of it being a more honest representation, there's something, I don't know, not endearing certainly, but I guess there's more honest about it. And I guess less dark as well. I mean, the person that can, you know, coldly commit atrocities without ever sort of showing a drop of sweat is certainly, I think, darker than the person that commits similar atrocities and goes crazy because of it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And also the predator, who looks like a loving, caring, paternal figure, but turns into a monster once the doors are closed, is much more frightening than the predator, who you can see right off is a pretty scary guy. I mean, Jimmy Savile comes to mind, and obviously he's hardly a paragon of anything at all, but it's pretty scary to think that Jimmy Savile may actually be less demonic or less of, you know, sociopathic than some of these other characters, if only because it was kind of apparent by his appearance and his behavior that there was something wrong there.
Right. As long as it's off the record.
Yeah.
One strange encounter I had with him was...
Redacted anecdote. Sure. Well, and that could be, and again, very speculative, but that could be an example of a conscious or an unconscious way of testing, in this case, you, or by exposing you to something that is potentially shocking if you are moral or squeamish, but not actually illegal, right? So
sure.
Definitely a way. I mean, he may have been observing your responses and just trying to gauge you, or he may not. It may have just been organic. But it's easy to see how that kind of thing could be consciously used, just to get a sense of somebody and whether they're trustworthy with inverted commas. I mean, trustworthy to be untrustworthy kind of thing.
Sure. And I've had a couple of experiences like that where a person of some power in the industry overshares, you know what I mean? Like one time, have you seen The Sopranos?
Sorry, what was that?
Have you seen The Sopranos?
Yeah, just a few episodes, not the whole thing.
Okay. Well, one of the actors in The Sopranos, his name is Vincent Pastore. He played Big Pussy Bombancero on the screen. You may or may not remember him.
Mm-hmm.
He worked. He was on the same movie actually. In addition to, do you know who Chuck Zito is?
No.
Chuck Zito was the head of the New York chapter of the Hell's Angels, and worked as a celebrity bodyguard in the '80s, like big time, like Sylvester Stallone, one of his closest friends, O.J. Simpson, he was a bodyguard for.
Right.
You look this guy up. He was a big time bodyguard, and also, like I said, he was in the Hell's Angels. He was on the set as well. And I remember having a conversation with the two of them, where I think it was Chuck Zito. He was trying to hit on or proposition like one of the young actresses on the set, and I got to talking to them. Oh no, it was what I was talking to them about was how Chuck had dated Pamela Anderson, right? I said, oh, you know, because like obviously, you know, I was younger, she was like hot, whatever. Oh, you know, Chuck, she dated Pamela Anderson, and I was talking to Vince about Stewart, and he started going on this long thing about how describing in intimate detail to me both of their situations with erectile dysfunction, and how he took the pills, but Chuck used like this, you know, whatever the syringe medication is for erectile dysfunction. And in graphic detail, I can come when I use this one, and he can come when he uses that one, but I barely knew them. You know what I mean? I barely knew these guys. But just the way that he so openly went into detail about these sexual, you know what I mean? This graphic sexual detail.
Right.
To me, displays a long history of being around such graphic is the wrong word. I'm talking about in person, who knows the type of orgies, even the most innocent is the wrong word, but let's just use it for lack of a better term. The most innocent orgies, right? Where it's just a lot of people having a lot of sex, all consensual, quote unquote. But there's so much of that over so many years that you are so desensitized to sex that even in the most casual of encounters, you are comfortable talking about or exposing your innermost, like, sexual, you know what I mean, secrets or whatever, just to me says something about the culture these people have been wrapped up in for so long.
Timely, because I just did a blog post about, quote, my penis, unquote. Not really about erectile dysfunction, but it's in there. And it was part one of the reasons I did it, or central to why I did it, was it's just an area that I've, understandably to you, I'm sure I'm very uncomfortable talking about publicly. It's just like, this is something I wanted to keep private. But I just thought, well, why? You know, I talk about so much, you've read, seen and not seen. I'll talk about masturbating to images of women being raped. I mean, that's a hell of a lot darker. It's you know, there's a lot more reason to keep that secret than just, you know, that I have some, you know, weird sexual, not weird, but some sexual issues with my wife, right? But you know, one didn't feel that vulnerable making, for whatever reason, maybe because I'm comfortable with dark stuff, and the other did, and I consciously chose to do it partly just to see what would happen and would it be okay, and sure, it was fine, but it was difficult, and I did feel pretty weird and exposed for a couple of days afterwards, as if I'd, you know, posted dick pics on my blog or something like that. But anyway, it's just interesting to contrast that, you know, with what you're saying, for people for whom it just is nothing at all, you know, just
right. You know, in a professional environment, you know, semi-professional, none of these sets are really professional. Obviously, they're more like field trips when you're in middle school. That's what I compare them to, at least. But I think, you know, not as much related to you, but I think the erectile dysfunction thing is really an interesting thing to look at, because I find that, and you tell me what you think about this, with the popularity and prevalence of pornography, you know, online pornography, the readily available nature of it, the graphic nature of it, the way that, you know, starting certainly with my generation and sometime before that, starting when you're 12 years old, you are looking at, you know, these hyper graphic, hypersexual images are being just zapped right into your brain, as many as you want, as graphic as you want, all day, every day, from when you're 12 years old throughout, you know, your adult life, if you never, like, you know, kick the habit.
Sure.
And, you know, two things happen. Certainly, I mean, some studies have been done and stuff about how there's like a lot of erectile dysfunction happening with young men because A, they're so used to jerking off to just images on camera that they're not, their bodies aren't connected to their sexuality in the natural way. And B, they slowly, you know, need more graphic images, like the more graphic, the more extreme fetishes to be able to get off. Then when they have a woman in front of them and they're just, you know, making out or whatever, initiating sex, that doesn't get them off.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting because when you look at the cultural, a lot of the cultural interference of these powers that be, I suppose, like if you look at, you know, the Laurel Canyon book and you read about how this sort of sexual freedom part of hippiedom had been mostly a lot of that had been started and encouraged by these covert forces in the U.S. government. You think about that guy, David Pilecki, right, and all in his band of dancers and the hippie culture and how all that sexual freedom stuff.
Right.
I see similarities to that now with the pornography and how ultimately what it does is, and this, the erectile function is to me secondary. It's almost like a symptom of it. But what it does mm-hmm. is normalizes the exact same type of fetishes and sexual proclivities that these ultra wealthy people end up getting because they have access to so much sex in real life. Right.
Yeah.
You see all these wealthy people, you know, I'm sure, you know, whatever, hopeful movie star A, right. Maybe they're a regular guy. They, you know, they've dated, they've had girlfriends, they've, you know, whatever, then they become famous. Well, now you have a buffet of whatever sexual desire you could possibly want. Every girl, whatever age, whatever race, however she looks, the most beautiful of them all, five at a time, every single night, every single day if you want it, right? Eventually, mm-hmm. you start needing weirder and weirder stuff, as we see with these people going back, got that, you know, thousands of years, the Marquis de Sade, whatever. And I just think mm-hmm. that it's so interesting the way that pornography ends up having the exact same effect on a person as this ultra wealth does and this access to sex. And to me, that's seems to be a coordinated effort to normalize all of this abuse, you know. And you see it a lot also with like the sort of the leftist perspectives on kinks and mm-hmm. sex work, right?
Yeah.
And I consider myself leftist, but I'm kind of like an anti, I don't want to call myself anti sex work as much. To me, that's an umbrella term that it includes too much, but certainly anti pornography and certainly the most exploitative sex work, I mean, can say that, sure. But you see these things and it's like, well, this is exactly what they want. This is exactly what the people we're supposed to be opposing want. You know, this is exactly what the worst people amongst us do. The worst people in history, what do they love? They love incest. They love underage kids. They love jailbait and obviously below that. They love orgies. They love S&M. They love torturing people. They love putting people in cages. It's the exact same collective psychological, like psychosexual effect that becoming wealthy and famous and even just wealthy is reflected in pornography and even in these political sexual expression movements. And I think that the erectile dysfunction is a similar theme running throughout all of them, you know?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And even that there's a correlation or an overlap between sadistic domination, which is easy to see as a way for an insecure ego, and we're talking particularly about males, but I don't think it should be restricted to males, would compensate for that insecurity by, you know, having total control over the other partner, even to the point of, you know, violently using violence, getting turned on by violence. That's a way to, you know, push us completely against the fear and the feeling of powerlessness that intimacy causes. But there's also, it's easy for me to see an overlap between that kind of sadistic sexual drive, the rape, you know, the drive to rape and dominate and abuse, with the desire to have sex with children, insofar as children, obviously they're easy to dominate, but that's part of something larger, really, which is that a child isn't a threat. Even the look of a child, as in even a child seeing oneself, you know, being sexual with them, is not going to have the same kind of intimidating effect as a fully grown adult is. In other words, like as an adult male who's insecure around his sexuality or is finding it harder and harder to maintain an erection, one of the ways to get around that is to start having sex with younger and younger people, because they're less and less experienced, so they're going to be less and less of a threat in terms of performance anxiety and so on and so forth. So I do think there's probably an exponential thing there, whereby what you're describing, like the more sex a person has because of their power and their wealth and their fame, the harder it becomes to get turned on, the more they have to go into these kinky weird things that include both sadism and children, just in order to be able to get it up. I mean, that's mostly intuitive and deductive, but it's somewhat experiential in terms of having a long-term marriage. What I found was that at a certain point, the intimacy did become quite scary to me, and I did start to have difficulty performing. And one of the ways that I compensated for that was just being much more dominating and controlling.
Mm.
Right. So,
right.
So, yeah.
I think.
So, yeah.
I think that even if you take away the sexual nature of it, right? We talked earlier about this instinctive drive to feel powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Relative to your fellow man, right? Like I spoke about it in terms of my own self, that desire to be dominant in a way over my peers, you know, people I went to high school with, let's say,
mm-hmm.
family members. Like we all have that instinctive drive. Well, what happens when you have all the power in the world you want? When you can get whatever you want, when you can go wherever you want, when you can be with whoever you want, there's nothing that you can't have. And eventually, wouldn't you get bored? Wouldn't you be seeking real power, real control, or not even real, but just more of it, and needed more extreme ways until you're literally, you know, the counts from Solo, you know, isn't that a natural progression of that same, I don't know about natural, but can't that be seen as a progression of that same drive for power once you've achieved all of the worldly powers that are perceptible to the normal person? Especially if you have no interest in like world domination or controlling like, you know, militaries or anything like that. Isn't that one of the next steps? Maybe the final step, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the things I've tried to do with my work, I mean, since Seen and Not Seen, and the two that came after Vice, The Prisoner of Infinity and Vice of Kings, and now 60 Maps of Hell, is to try, because we were talking before, like, where do you go with all this? You can't ever really confirm exactly what kind of conspiracy or how the whole thing is configured, you know, without being initiated into it. One's never really going to be able to map it in that regard, in terms of the specifics, you know, who does what to who and when and why and how, and you know, all that stuff. Like, one doesn't want to have first-hand experience of that, God forbid. So one is maybe, you know, could end up spending a lifetime speculating and theorizing, and it wouldn't be a very enjoyable time that one would have. So the way that I've tried to approach it, the alternative that I've tried to apply is, well, twofold. One, looking at my, as you've just said, looking at my own corresponding pathology there, and how, you know, I haven't fed it. I've tried to starve it so that it hasn't taken over. And, you know, and part of that has been identifying it and letting myself see it, partly by looking at the world and these other cultural aberrations. And the other way is trying to deduce and intuit, a bit of a combination of the two, you know, what's the rationalization behind these behaviors? Because, you know, human beings, they always have a rationalization. And the more twisted and depraved our behaviors become, or the more anti-natural, the more sophisticated our rationalizations have to become. And I think, you know, whole philosophies get built out. I mean, Foucault's coming to mind because you mentioned the leftist thing, you know, sexual liberation. But certainly Marquis de Sade, whole philosophies come out of rationalizing pathologies. And the philosophy that I suspect that I've you know, somewhat been able to map around this is the philosophy goes back to Sparta and Greece, that what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, and that to really train a child or to create a powerful culture maker is similar to how they created powerful warriors in the past. You have to inflict sustained abuses and trauma on them so that they become so desensitized on the one hand and so traumatized on the other that they're both driven to achieve, you know, absurd successes, and at the same time they're so insensitive that they're kind of invulnerable to the point that they're able to do absolutely anything to achieve those ends.
Mm-hmm.
Like those, that kind of shaping of the psyche to create a particular kind of individual, I think goes back to how aristocracies are created and maintain themselves. And Hollywood, of course, is a modern aristocracy. So why not? You know, maybe we shouldn't be surprised if there's a systemic child abuse factor there, because on the one hand you've got a perfect storm really of these pathological egos who can't function sexually without pursuing more and more aberrational sex, and on the other hand you've got this let's say ancient tradition of creating or shaping psyches in such a way they will become you know, powerful cultural figures as a rationale for it.
Right.
And that creates a sort of perfect storm of complicity, because I mean, I was thinking about Bryan Singer when I was writing about it. For all these kids who came out and spoke about what he was doing, how many didn't speak about it? Part not just because they were afraid, but because they became successful through submitting to those abuses, and not just because they got the deal, but because their psyches were configured or whatever. The trauma actually drove them on to success. Like Michael Jackson is a classic example.
Right, right. Well, I mean, you're 100% right with the perfect storm thing. When you think about the power these people have to make your whole life, everything you ever wanted, everything anybody could ever want, right? Much of which is because this is sold to them, right? Through movies and television, where else would it be sold to them? Through the media. But, you know, whatever the causes of it are, these people, your mother, your father, your fucking extended family, yourself, everything you ever wanted, the yachts, the mansions, the fame, the popper, everything you've ever wanted and been told to want and been conditioned to want from when you were born, they have that in their hand. They hold that in. They hold your entire life in their hand. When you're in a meeting with these people, when you go into that office, they have it all. They can make your life. Snap of finger. Not I'll hire you, here's your salary, here we're the biggest financing firm in the world, but you have to come in 9 to 5. This is here's millions of dollars, here's it all, right? So yeah, I mean, it does create that perfect storm, even on the surface level, of not only the perfectly built exploiters, but the perfectly built exploited. That creates this, you know, perfect endless cycle of abuse and exploitation that really is what the entire industry runs on. And I just wonder, do you think that people get initiated into this? Let's say there's like a 30-year-old person who becomes a movie star. Do you think that who's like a normal person in their life up until that moment? Do you think that those people get initiated into this often, or do you think it's more sort of like the Mickey Mouse Club people who are groomed and selectively placed throughout the industry to keep these things going, and, you know, in whatever way they do, you know, how do you think that works? Because on one hand, it would seem to be really easy for, you know, right before you sign your deal to be the next, you know, Batman, for them to say, okay, listen, here's the deal. We can kill you and your entire family in the snap of a finger. It'll look like a car accident. There's nothing you will ever be able to do. Nobody will ever be in trouble for it. These are the powers we have. We can watch every single thing you possibly do with your cell phone. You will never be safe. Or you can comply with all these things and you can be a movie star and everything you ever want to be taken care of. To me, it seems like they'd be able to do that pretty easily, and they wouldn't be lying. And would then be able to control that? Or do do you think it's more of like a selective thing where they condition these people from youth?
It is sad that you cannot be found. Under rocks, a broken skull, I will lay down. I will lay down. I can be found beneath the road. Beneath the road. Safe to say that I'll never be found. Broken bones holding loose, you will be crowned. You will be crowned queen of all you have found. You have found.
It's interesting. I mean, it's because there's a problem with that, the hypothesis, your first hypothesis about just applying terror tactics overtly like that, which is that, and that's the organized crime way, and that does speak to this question, you know, is Hollywood an organized crime ring / intelligence operation? And if so, you know, are they all just pretending to be something they're not? Or are there levels of performance that we can't even imagine going on here, where gangsters look like George Clooney? But anyway, putting that aside for now, the if they were just using terror tactics, you would think that a person would be so terrified their whole life that they wouldn't really be able to be very effective as Brad Pitt, you know, or
sure,
Angelina Jolie. The strain would show, you would think, right? So
right.
So my guess is that's very unusual. And you can imagine, really, like the steel fist or whatever doesn't like to take off the velvet glove unless it has to. It can work so much better. And particularly, we're talking in Hollywood, and it's one thing if you join the mafia or you join a Mexican drug cartel, you know that these are hard-ass psychopathic murderers, and that's all part of the deal, right? They're not hiding anything because it would defeat the purposes to hide it. Whereas Hollywood, as you were saying, in order to maintain its power, it has to be able to condition new generations of children into believing that this is the holy grail of life on earth. So it has to maintain the illusion that it's a beautiful place, a glamorous land where all your dreams will be fulfilled. So it has to conceal all of this, you know, the abuse, the manipulation, the control, the fear tactics. And that would include, presumably, in a way, it would include the members too, but obviously not exactly, because if you're an insider and you're being initiated, whether you're a child or not, you're going to be terrorized. That's going to be part of the initiation.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, yeah, it raises an interesting question, like how many movie stars or directors have actually genuinely made it later in life, and don't have a background that like David Fincher, for example, he didn't make it till his 20s or what have you, but he grew up next door to George Lucas, right? And so he got breaks on Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom and Return of the Jedi. I think he was assistant cameraman or something like that. So okay, so he had a foot in the door because his father worked for Time magazine, was an editor at Time magazine, which is Henry Lucci, which is, you know, Operation Mockingbird, CIA. So it's pretty easy to see from there. Well, okay, so Fincher already had his foot in the door when he was 5 years old, but that doesn't necessarily imply that he was being sexually abused and psychologically configured during that period, but it certainly means it's possible. And so there could be, it could be, I mean, obviously this would be paranoid speculation, or it could be seen as too speculative, but it could be that even somebody like Brad Pitt, say, who we think only made it, like, wasn't he just sort of discovered in his early 20s and then suddenly he's Brad Pitt? So as far as I know, there isn't much about, he wasn't a child actor anyway, simply put, but it's possible that one of the things they, well, actually here's, I mean, there's more than one possibility. I mean, one is that children are actually selected at an early age and kind of recruited in hidden ways, and then only later are they discovered, in quotes. That's definitely more speculative, or at least more paranoid. Another possibility is that they're profiled, that somebody like Brad Pitt or whatever is profiled, and it's found out that he did suffer, and I don't know if this is true or not, but early child abuse. Therefore, it is known that he has the kind of psychological trauma imprints that will make it very easy for him to be controlled in the necessary way. And I don't like speculating to this much, because I know I can end up like I'll get invited on Alex Jones or something. But I'm trying to answer your question, because I hadn't really thought about it. Actually, but it's a very good one, like, because most famous Hollywood people weren't child actors. I mean, we know the ones that were, and Robert Downey Jr. was my first case study in 60 Mouths of Hell, and that led me to Stage Manor. Do you know about Stage Manor? I think it's called, in New York, it's like a training ground for kids, musical kids.
No, I don't.
It's very interesting. I mean, you know, Stage Door Manor, I think it's called. Yeah, most people have not heard of it. I haven't heard of it. But the people who went there describe it as a secret society and like the mafia. I mean, just like that. I mean, of course, they can couch it as a bit jokey, or as a lot jokey, but still, they're using those terms. Anyway, Downey Jr. went there, and a number of other now famous stars, and it's, yeah, it's for kids to learn musical talents. And of course, talent agents go there, and talent agents have private auditions sometimes with those kids. So perfectly possible that it's also a kind of child brothel.
Yes.
Obviously, that would be inflammatory, or, you know, to suggest that, but I'm just saying, I mean, it, one has to kind of flip it around and not say, well, this could be that or this could be that. But hypothetically, if what we think is going on in Hollywood is going on, what would it look like? And that's one of the things you would expect to see, would be, as you were saying about these houses that are being set up, exactly that, houses that front as talent training grounds, will also serve as that, but double as you know, places where sexual predators can have access to kids, and that those two things are compatible and consistent. They're part of the training.
Right. Well, I mean, you can definitely see it. And if you're looking the right way, right? Like I said, it's about perspective, where me and person B, who's at a similar level of exposure to the industry, have seen the same things. Because I have some context, I can see the you know, tips of the icebergs scattered across the industry of where right underneath those things, all this stuff, you know, allegedly or theoretically is going on. And what you're mentioning definitely sounds like one of those things, right? And you almost want to say, like, well, why wouldn't it be? You know, yeah. Like, there's so much presented to us, on the surface level to say these things are going on. These things are going on, where you see something like that, and well, why the hell, why wouldn't it be a child brothel? You know what I mean? Like, why wouldn't it be? I mean, do these people have morals? These people have, you know what I mean? Why would we be relying upon them to be normal people, or to be moral people, or to not want to, you know, hurt children? They've never done anything. They've never done anything to show us that they are those people. In fact, they've done much of the opposite. So
no. Yeah, well, and that question, I'd even say, you know, how couldn't it be? Not just why wouldn't it be, but how couldn't it be if this is the way that the industry works? And I think it's a very good question, a non-rhetorical question, because I think it leads to possibly a partial answer, which is the reason that it's so hard for us to think about this is because we've also been configured by this culture that's being created out of, you know, these hidden machinations. So it's glamour magic. It creates cognitive dissonance, and this is very much what 60 Maps of Hell is partly about, but it's certainly stemming from this place within myself that constantly has cognitive dissonance to this day between what I've grown up believing about Hollywood and what I now believe, based on all the evidence, that the two things contradict each other so profoundly that it's impossible to kind of hold both in consciousness at the same time. And yet that's the only way to make sense of it, because clearly it's not just, you know, Hollywood isn't just a CIA mind control operation for you know, pathological predatorial pedophiles to create armies of darkness. It isn't just that. It's also a place where they make movies that we love, right? So,
right.
So they have to coexist, but they can't, because the same culture that has, you know, instilled us with Hollywood values has also instilled us with values, well, or at least it's had to. Be consistent with values that say all that's just wrong. I mean, that's just so morally abhorrent that only monsters could do those things. And clearly, you know, whoever, Brad Pitt or George Clooney or David Fincher, they couldn't be monsters because they're creating movies that I love. So the answer seems to be, I guess, within, really, as in, you know, what the very same forces that have possessed these agents of control in Hollywood and these culture makers, we've allowed ourselves to be possessed by, and so we're not really able to see the nature of the world. I mean, we're not able to see nature of reality. And of course, I mean, to bring it back to ground, I'm more comfortable on, or more, I feel like I've got my feet more securely on that. That's what trauma does. I mean, trauma fragments us so that we dissociate from reality, and we really aren't playing with a full deck at all. We're playing we think we're playing one game, but we're actually, you know, playing another entirely different game. And yeah, we're in a dream world.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Matrix metaphor, as you've referenced, and the dream world thing, I think it's actually incredibly accurate, because if you look at discourse, I guess modern discourse, political, cultural, all of it, all of the popular versions of it, at least, talk about the world at large, our world, the United States, whatever, in ways that are completely fictional. Right? People have no idea how things really work, what really goes on, how decisions are made that affect us, what decisions are made that affect us, what things we're perceiving are affecting us, how they're affecting us. Nobody has any idea. So it is almost like we really are living in a matrix of sort, whether literally or figuratively, where we are so conditioned. We're so constantly conditioned from the second that we're born to believe the military is virtuous, the police are virtuous, Hollywood is virtuous, the celebrities are virtuous, you know, the politicians are virtuous, that we spend our entire lives living in and thinking about and talking about and engaging with a completely fictional world, completely mm-hmm. fictional reality, right?
Yeah.
You know, you think, like, I think about how many people that I know who are otherwise intelligent people, you know, think Barack Obama is a virtuous, you know what I mean, person. Like, yeah. even, forget, who knows what he's doing behind closed doors, right? I mean, like I said, he was on David Geffen's yacht. I certainly don't want to speculate about that kind of thing. But you, think, you look at his, the military, you know, force that he's been, that he's used. I mean, the slaughter of children, right there, public record. Mm-hmm. How many articles can you possibly find from every single reliable source in the world? I mean, mm-hmm. just public fact, right? That he's murdering children. And how many people think that he's a virtuous person? I mean, that is so far removed from reality that anybody that engages on those terms is talking about a matrix by any reasonable, you know, definition, you know, right up until the, you know, the plugs are plugged right into our brain, you know? So, mm-hmm. and who is selling that to us? Where do we get all of these references from? You know, where it comes from, Hollywood. And so I think, you know, the exact model on top of which Hollywood operates, right? Selling an image, getting you to buy in, exploiting you because you buy into this image, and only through that exploitation can we be successful. I mean, you could say the entire world operates that way, and Hollywood is the one that's doing much of the, is doing all of the image selling, you know?
It's occurred to me recently that maybe one of the reasons that we love watching movies and TV shows, and just maybe I should say I do, it's because we're being pretended to the whole time. You know, we're, like you say, we're living in this massive conspiracy that involves all of us to pretend that things are different than they are. And so at least watching a movie and TV show provides some relief, because we know, you know, we know that we're being lied to.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Because it's horrible. It's a horrible experience. And it's probably one we grew up with, being lied to and pretended and being, you know, surrounded by fakeness, and not being able to say anything, you know, not even knowing what's wrong, because if we don't have anything to compare it to, how do we know? I mean, we just know this feels wrong and this feels fake, but apparently no one else is saying anything, so maybe I'm wrong, maybe something's wrong with me. That's how I felt growing up. It's a terrible feeling, right? So and I escaped into movies. I literally escaped into fantasy, where I didn't believe that it was real, but at least I knew I wasn't supposed to believe it was real.
Right, right. I think one of the things that the, I guess the powers that be most despise, most don't want, are people waking up and saying, oh my God, this, you know, 17-year-old kid that I know overdosed on opioids, this guy lost his job, this person had to, you know, get a second mortgage on their house because their kid, you know, broke his ankle. Why is everything so fucking horrible? Like, why mm-hmm. is the world so horrible? Like, I've been sold this world where everything's possible and everything's great. And if you work hard and if you're good to your neighbors and if you're good to your family, everything will come to you. Well, that's not true. Everyone's miserable. Everyone's in debt and being hounded, you know, by debt collectors and getting sick and being obese and getting murdered. I mean, it's just like, you know, they don't want people waking up and thinking that. And movies provide a place for you to watch and go, oh, that's what a virtuous life looks like. Oh, there are good stories in the world. Oh, there are heroes. Oh, there are happy endings. Oh, you know, even when there's a, you know, an honest movie about something sad or something dark or about poverty or about immigration or whatever. Oh, but you know, at the end of the day, the good guys will win and we'll all love each other. And if you're, even if you're poor, even if you're sick, even if you're dying, well, you bring your family around and you give them a hug and you give them a kiss and the music will play and the credits will roll and everything will be happy. So I think that keeps people complacent and complicit, engages their minds in these fantasies that allow them to even daydreams can be, you know, can make one complacent and can ease your soul. Even fantasizing about being Batman.
Sure, of course.
By taking power and beating up the bad guys and ridding the world of evil as accuracy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, I mean, that's a specific power fantasy, of course. But then there's the more subtle kind, which, I mean, one of the ways we placate ourselves in the face of a nightmarish kind of social reality is by telling ourselves that we're virtuous. So even some of those movies you're talking about, they might not even have a happy ending, but they leave the audience feeling like they're virtuous.
Sure.
For having watched it, right? It's one of the virtue signaling movies that allow the audiences to go out and virtue signal and feel more virtuous. And of course, that's so much part of our culture now on social media, this whole thing of virtue signaling, that I think that's another layer of it, is that no matter how bad the world is, if as long as we can feel that we're in the right or we're good people, then we can, you know, we can handle it, we can cope with it. But it's contradictory because, you know, the world, I mean, well, or at least it seems that it doesn't help. I mean, the people who are talking about making the world a better place generally are hell-bent on the exact opposite, whether they're in mean it or not.
Right.
It's complicated, isn't it? But certainly the ones who are busy fucking the world and everyone in it are the ones, the first ones to say they're making the world a better place. We know that. So, I mean, I want to bring it back to maybe more personal grounds. I had a couple of questions for you about you in Hollywood. One was, I guess, continuing the last point, do you feel, are you conflicted in your own life in terms of wanting to make movies that you hope would make a difference and thinking that maybe that's naive? And I mean, do you have any ambivalence about not just that it might be naive, but that you could this could be a trick that's keeping you inside the very hamster wheel that you want to get out of?
I would say that I am irrevocably addicted to the mist of finding out, you know what I mean, what is to come and what is there for me and for anybody, I guess, in my position. I'm curious in every way that I can be. I'd like to think maybe I can sneak one in. You know what I mean? Maybe that's what we all think, or everyone thinks, and then the next day they're a lizard person. I don't know, but you know, I don't know how much of a choice that I have. I feel a lot of comfort in reading about these things. I guess, you know, you can call them conspiracy, whatever, you know, work like yours. I love reading Dave McGowan's work. I mean, as dark as it is, I found it incredibly, incredibly comforting to me to have this base of knowledge and to understand, okay, all right, well, this is why things are the way they are. This is what's going on in so many words, whatever. Obviously, I don't know every single little way it works, but I think you can get a general understanding that we're not seeing the whole picture if we're seeing 1% of it. I find that to be comforting and to be able to focus my work around those ideas and whatever seems to be helpful. I like engaging in, you know, more of the research, such as what I'm doing with these like social media houses, like I mentioned. I think maybe that's an interesting thread to go on. I think that what I have so far on that could be a big news story. I mean, these are very powerful people. Certainly, you know, certainly these social media kids, just the fact that the person that's running them is basically a person that works for, like, at the very least, some sort of GOP intelligence network. He has heavy ties to Israel. I know that for 100% fact. So it's hard for me to imagine that it's just like some GOP, you know, plot. I think that's pretty naive to imagine that. I think that would be pretty inflammatory just on its own. And maybe that would be, maybe if that got exposed, which I certainly think there's a lot to be exposed there with this new network of like these social media things. So, and that's a little diverting away from my specific work in Hollywood, but I see ways, and maybe this is naive, I don't know. Either way, like I said, I want to find out that I maybe could find some way to do good. And I'm sure that I guess in itself is sort of like a masturbatory idea, I suppose. But I do have hope for that. And I guess I don't really have much choice for many different reasons other than to follow the thread and find out. And
When I started it off, as I said, I always thought that maybe I'd end up bartending on the beach in Mexico. So I suppose I'm still open to that plan if that's necessary. If the lizards expose themselves to me, and I can make a clean break.
Do you feel that? I mean, clearly, you're, like you say, you're hoping you could sneak one in. So theoretically, it's possible to do good work even within a corrupt or a malevolent industry, let's say, if it is that. But do you feel that there are people in Hollywood who've been successful that somehow aren't complicit with this? Is that possible? Or even in a more general sense, do you feel that success, worldly success, or, you know, renown, being recognized, having a large audience, etc., is possible the way the world's configured, or not? Because that's a problem I have, is really, you know, I don't even know if I should be aspiring to any kind of success based on what I know about the world.
Right. Well, I definitely think about it, certainly, especially recently as I've been reading more into these things. And I think that goes back to the original question, not the original question, but one of the questions we covered, which is like, well, how many people are aware of these things and complicit in these things? The much darker parts of them. You know, is Paul Schrader, you know what I mean? Is he going to child sex work? I don't know. I would certainly be disappointed. I mean, that would certainly wouldn't bode well for me, I'd say. But, you know, we don't know. And I certainly can't shake that desire, or the many desires that all point me in the direction of at least exploring it and seeing it for what it is. And I mean, do you think there are any movies that you can think of that are good work that do expose, but touch on these very real issues and the way the world works? I mean, you know, like Hardcore, for example, which you brought up. I mean, that seems to me like a movie that explores the way the world really works more than certainly most movies, and as much as I suppose one really can. I mean, is he part of the game? Is that just a limited hangout, you know, called in from lately? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's so hard.
This is how I address this in 60 Maps of Hell, and that is that for Hollywood to continue to have the influence, and this may all be obsolete, you know, maybe the Hollywood is already a dying beast, but anyway, so far, for it to have continued to have the power and influence that it's had, it needs a steady stream of acclaim. It needs to have the credentials. It can't just be seen as a propaganda machine inside of which is you know, networks of abuse and sex trafficking. Obviously, there'd be no future for that. So there's a conundrum there, which is that you or I, in theory, could participate in making what we would think of as a great movie, and maybe even was a great movie. I mean, one could pick one's favorite great movie or what have you, and whether or not it was overtly subversive. And it may truly be a work of art that opens people's eyes to certain realities, but in the process of doing so, it validates the very system that's made it possible.
Sure.
And that's presumably why and how these things are possible. So then that leaves one with the question, you know, is it worth it? Am I doing a little good, you know, on the one hand, while actually giving power to something that's doing so much more evil on the other? That's kind of impossible to know, I suppose.
Right.
And I also wanted to say about Paul Schrader, that what do you think, because I have the same question, even specifically about Paul Schrader. For some reason, I listen to a lot of his interviews, and I mean, I tend to go, you know, where the greatest cognitive dissonance is, you know, can I really believe, or Robert Altman's another, who just seems like, surely not Robert Altman, I mean, come on, like how, but anyway, my question is, even if we allow that somebody like Paul Schrader could become Paul Schrader and not go to the parties and participate in them, is it possible that he wouldn't know about them?
Right. I mean, it would be hard for me to believe that. But then when you get that question, okay, Paul Schrader, he knows of them. Maybe he's even been to them, but he hasn't committed. He hasn't, like, you know, had sex with a child. I mean, this is obviously hypothetical, whatever. But what if, well, he has, I mean, we know Paul Schrader's career. We know he hasn't done that. But what if a person like that were to then use their platform, use their financial independence to then do some actual good, expose something? And this goes into a larger thing, which I was curious what you thought about it. To me, a path to change in the world, to me, most clearly seems that it would be initiated by a large scale, widespread education about some of these very things that we're discussing, right? The conspiracies, the things that are going on behind the closed doors, you know, exposing these things. In theory, if someone were to be aware of and be aware of this culture, stay at arm's length from it, be aware of it while getting these small wins in, right? The movies that are good, in to then hopefully one day do something real good. I mean, is that possible? Is that, you know what I mean? Like, is that something that, to me, that's the path to becoming successful and being virtuous. But I don't know. I mean, do you think that's possible?
Well, I think it wouldn't be possible for me. So then, and of course I'm not successful in that regard. So then I guess you'd have to ask yourself that question, because for me, I can't imagine, say, if I was Paul Schrader and I had some success with Taxi Driver, say, but, you know, it was before I was really, you know, becoming a player within the industry, or the very beginning of it, and then I started to have intimations about what was going on. Yeah, maybe I'd continue and just, you know, to be sure, and then, but a certain point would come where I'm seeing, or at least I'm hearing, you know, more than rumors. I'm hearing testimonies, or getting a sense that something really, really terrible is going on. And I choose not to mention it, as in I'm doing interviews and people are asking about how it is in Hollywood and making movies. And I'm thinking, well, actually, you know, yesterday I heard that this 8-year-old was raped at something, and then, you know, nobody did anything about it, or whatever it was, right? If I start hearing about these things and I'm making a choice, I better not talk about them, because I can't back it up anyway, and it won't do any good. You know, how long is that going to go on before I start just feeling fucking awful about the whole situation? Like, that's what I wonder. Like, I can't see myself being able to rationalize, well, I'll just keep quiet about this. I know it's going on, but I can't, you know, the criminal, they probably wouldn't be prosecuted if I said anything, so I'd just be sabotaging my career. So, but I'll make some good movies. I just feel as though that would be so dissociative.
Right.
You know, to have to do that.
Good.
I mean, I agree with you, certainly, in terms of my own morality and just in general. But isn't that exactly what must be happening for all of people? I mean, I think it'd be hard for me to, for either of us to believe that, you know, you and I and anybody like us are the only virtuous people that would ever consider a career in movies. And I think it's also hard to believe that they'd be able to pick out every single fucking person that had those virtues. Like, you know, is every single celebrity just quietly within themselves so okay with that they all just don't talk about it ever, never get together, like, you know? Or are they all pedophiles? Martin Scorsese and Paul Schrader and Robert Jr., are they all just pedophiles? And how does that get to be the case? That's hard. I just, as much as I can believe anything, I think it would be hard for me to think every single person of that level of significance are all
sure. Well, I think this is an example of how our faculties have been compromised, so precisely so that, or at least inseparable from the fact that we can't make sense of this. Because, I mean, even the thing about pedophiles, and as I write in 60 Maps of Hell, this is a big red herring, because first of all, like, raping and torturing a child isn't pedophilia. That's something else, something a hell of a lot worse than pedophilia. Second of all, on the other side of the spectrum, having sex with a 13-year-old isn't pedophilia either. It's hebephilia. It's very, very different. And anyone who thinks that it's just as bad to have sex with a 13-year-old as to have sex with a 5-year-old needs their head examined. They're not the same thing. So just use that as an example. Like, the frame that we're using is often the frame, or large components of it have been given to us by the very system that's trying to protect itself from being exposed. So when we ask questions, we're probably, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're the wrong questions. So yeah, is Paul Schrader, is Martin, are they pedophiles? Well, wrong question. Do they know about some of the things we're talking about, much more broad? Probably yes, right? We start where we are, I suppose. Like, if we know about these things, unless we're deluded, and we've always got to keep that on the table, then insiders obviously know about them. That's not even a deduction or an assumption. It's just a no-brainer.
Right.
They would have to know, because we know about them, right? Obviously, we don't know more than insiders, but they know more than us. So they've got a whole different context, and we don't know what it is. And one of the things that I've explored in recent books is that it may be that the context that they have is so foreign to us that we can barely understand it. And it doesn't have to include lizard people, but it could include that raping a child is nothing to be ashamed of, that it's a positive empowering act for the child and the abuser. Like, that they may actually believe that, and it's possible they all believe it because they're in a different culture. Like, if we go to a different land, you know, Borneo or whatever, or in the Amazon tribe, we'll find they all believe the same thing. But of course, they don't have, you know, they couldn't communicate with us, so there'd be this gulf. But what if there's a superculture where they have a completely different value set, but they also know all about our value set because they came from it, and so they speak 2 languages effectively?
Yeah, I mean, Like you've been saying, I mean, you have to at some point just begin to speculate. I think maybe, again, this is more naivete, but the idea that every single one of these people, every single one, like little things, Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey, I mean, nobody ever comes out and actually says this shit's going on. I mean, the stuff we're talking about, I mean, the murder and the rape of children. So every single one of them becomes so aware of and okay with, I guess it happens gradually, who knows exactly how it happens, I mean, that would make sense, and never get together and say, well, we're millionaires, we're extremely famous, they can't kill all of us, let's put an end to this. Never one time ever say that. To me, that's just hard to believe, and I just don't even know what the process by which every single one of these would be, people would be reliably initiated into this, that would be so consistent and so powerful that it would just never be exposed across all these different types of people.
Well, I mean, what about Randy Quaid, per se? I mean, because it seems there are There are the occasional celebrity who comes out and says weird stuff, but, and even Tom Sizemore, I mean, he didn't come out and say stuff, but he certainly, I mean, his career crashed and burned, and maybe it was partly not just because he couldn't take the pressure of being complicit with all that shit and trying to keep up with it, but also because he was showing the cracks too much, as in, you know, he's not good for the public image of Hollywood, kind of thing. And certainly Randy Quaid, well, he's off the chart, right?
Right.
And he's easy to dismiss because he's insane. Well, but where does it begin, you know? Where does the insanity begin? Does it, like, it's easy to imagine if there is a, and I shouldn't say if, we know there's a Hollywood culture and it's different from the culture at large in certain subtle ways. We don't know how different it is, but if it's a lot more different than we imagine, then and the pressure, I mean, you described it very well, just the people coming in at the beginning, they're just getting these auditions here and there with the lowest level, you know, whatever, D level casting agents and whatnot, and they're already been saying, if you suck my cock, you get this part,
right.
Ha ha ha, and it's all totally normal, and that's in the context of this is their ultimate dream and this is their only possible happiness. Imagine, you know, that's just the first level of that,
right.
How many people of the thousand people go to Hollywood don't make it to the next level, and then the next level, and then the next level. You have to, based on that, you have to really be so driven and so willing to compromise yourself to make it even past the first level. I mean, I can't imagine anything I'd want badly enough to suck Harvey Weinstein's cock. Come on, right?
Right.
But apparently there's millions of people who want it badly enough, and that's, obviously that's not the lowest level because it's Harvey Weinstein, but presumably before anyone got to suck his cock, I'm being very crude now, but they would have to, you know, done the same for much lower levels.
Of course, certainly.
So that's, I mean, by the time you're in Harvey Weinstein's hotel room, and one of the problems probably is that by the time you get there, you've got some power and clout, so you think maybe you're above this now, but it turns out you're not, because there's higher levels of abuse and power and all the rest of it. But what I was going to say, the level of indoctrination and normalization that you've been subjected to, it's easy to imagine that if you start cracking and or wanting to get the hell out and blow the whistle, and they might be kind of go chicken and egg style, then it would be so destabilizing that one could easily end up like Randy Quaid. I mean, one just, it's so hard to locate yourself within the culture. If you've join this other culture and then you want to get out, and somehow you've got to make sense to the culture that you had to leave behind, that you know has no idea about what's going on, and that you'll probably sound like a maniac if you try and explain it, and also you've been complicit, so why is it taking you so long to talk about it? It's easy to imagine how a person would end up not just seeming bonkers but actually being, you know, pretty bonkers by the time they get to that point. And then, of course, they go, I mean, who talks about Randy Quaid? I presume you know a little bit about Randy Quaid's thing.
You're right. And I think there's also like it's all psychological, I suppose, but I think there's more of like a, I guess, clinical, that's the wrong word, whatever, psychological element to it, where there's something that, like, I just kind of jokingly call like rich people brain, where I think once you become a certain level of wealthy, how you treat people has no bearing on your life at all. You can treat people however you want, your personal, your family, your wife, your kids, your whatever, friends, anybody, your assistant, and you will still get whatever you want, whenever you want it, all day, every day, in every single way you can possibly imagine. Just, like, how you treat people, this has no bearing on your personal life. And over time, you don't need to care about how you treat people or what you do or anything. Eventually your brain starts to literally shift, and then you can become a worse person, a less empathetic person, and a less aware person. I think that is like a general you know, psychological, you know, development. And I think the same can be said about these people in Hollywood. I mean, whether you're the person that's gotten abused over and over and over and over again in ways that you and I can't even imagine, or maybe we can't imagine it, but I certainly can't imagine how it would feel and how that would affect you. And then you get to the top and you're like, well, that's just how it is. I went through it. Yeah. I have to go through it. I'm living an okay life. I have my Xanax and my whatever to deal with the pain, and my millions of dollars and my beautiful husband and my beautiful kids or wife, whatever. So maybe it's like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, actually, more than Xanax, they have their perverse sexual ritual abuses to deal with the pain.
Sure. But I mean, even people that maybe aren't, maybe the more virtuous or as virtuous as they can be, people who maybe, let's just say they are, and I think it would be hard for me,
right,
every single person is into it. Maybe they're aware of it and complicit in it, and they've been involved in it as the victim.
Right. Sure. You know, okay. Yeah.
Kind of people. But one thing I wanted to mention, I think it fits into this. One of the experiences that I've had that was most jarring to me, which has affected me for years since then, was, I remember one of the first days I ever worked on a movie set. I got this PA job, you know, this PA job unpaid. I've been driving up there an hour and a half to work every day. And the first few days I was like in an office, they were sending me on errands, whatever. And then the other producer got to the office, and he was the one that took a liking to me, and he was involved in more of like the real shit active, like around town and doing real things. So the first thing he had me do was, instead of going to the office that day, it was like the third day, he invited me to, they were doing extras auditions for extras. And it was at this like shitty hotel. And it was like a movie set in the 80s, really low budget movies, and no, you know, big names on it. But interestingly enough, Chris Farley's brothers were on it. And I actually got to talk to both of them. It was kind of interesting. But, and like I said, they're doing auditioning for actors of all ages, especially kids, because it was taking place in a high school. And it was set in the 80s, and they had to dress up like they were in the 80s. And unpaid work to be an extra on a super low budget movie. It was a feature film, you know, it was released on streaming services, but it was, you know, ultra, you know, wasn't released in theaters, anything like that. And people lined up to audition for it, and, you know, their kids and everything, many hundreds of people. And I, you know, was on the other side of things, right? I was sitting at the table where the people were coming in, and we were watching them, writing their names down, taking the pictures, observing them, talking about it. And so right there, it was like this first time where I kind of had stepped onto the other side of the screen. My entire life, I had been, even in the most minor way, my entire life, all I had been doing was watching this from the viewer's perspective. The screens, enraptured by it, enamored with it, mystified by it, in love with it, addicted to it, obsessed with it. Then on this day, I took the step on the other side and was watching the watchers, I suppose. And I'll never forget, there's this family came in. It was like a dad and, you know, mom, dad, and their three kids who were like between the ages of like 6 and 12, let's say. And then, you know, they came in and the kids were dressed up in the 80s outfits, and took pictures of them, and we're like, all right, you know, wrote their names, and we're like, all right, you know, thanks, well, we'll give you a call. And the guy, I'll never forget this, the dad was like, oh, you know, they can do a lot. They have different outfits. They can do, you know, referring to his kids. They can do so much. She's great. She can sing. She can do this. She can do that. You know, he'll do anything. He'll do anything. You know, and I want to make it clear, I don't mean like anything like in some sort of perverse way. I just mean like in the performance way. Mm-hmm. But just the way that he was like selling his kids, and just like it was that smell of desperation, that desperation to just reach out and just touch it, where I was just a regular kid 3 days ago. I was a regular 20-year-old kid just days ago. And he was just by nature of stepping on the other side, even just 1 inch on the other side, the desperate grabbing to just touch what he perceived us to, I guess, have or possess, to the point where he was selling his kids, pawning off their time, their energy for some fucking stupid movie. You know what I mean? The smallest, shittiest of them all. Was just so fascinating to me how powerful this is, not this, you know, but the industry and the entertainment and the movies and the lights and the cameras and the action and how obsessed people can be with it, even a normal person that's ever even been around it. And that was just something that always affected me. And there, everything I write, everything I think about, like the movie idea I told you about with the cult that makes the snuff films, how they sell you this image. You, every single person inside of them has this perception of Hollywood and how incredible it is, how virtuous it is, and how much better it is than their life, right? How if they could just get one teaspoon of it, it would be like eating ambrosia, literally, you know. And I think you make this comparison, right, to the gods of Olympus and these celebrities. It would be like tasting the ambrosia, whereas you had been your entire life eating gruel. And that is what they used to exploit. And that's how they exploit having insurance. So I just wanted to mention that because I thought that was just something that always affected me. It was only like my third day ever. And just was, to me, is a very instructive in like really how these things go.
Yeah, it's a disturbing anecdote in the context of everything we've been talking about. Right. Just bringing it down to the specifics. And it also occurred to me how that quality of desperation you're describing, basically people, parents, kids who would do anything to get a taste of this, were meeting, not in this case fortunately yourself, but you know, potentially meeting the kind of people you're describing who no longer feel there are any consequences for their actions.
Right.
Basically, they can do whatever they want and they're still going to be loved in this shallow way. So you can see those two psychological dynamics meeting, right? The desperate person who will do anything to be loved and the pathologically empowered person who doesn't give a fuck about what they do or the consequences of their action and is basically being served. Served up endless victims for that.
Oh yeah, it's a buffet. It's literally, it cannot be described in anything other than a, you know, Caesar's Palace buffet, all you can eat, served right to your table. The server literally opening up their mouths and shoveling. Just in the most extreme way you can even imagine. So that, yeah, you're right.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I say a bar in Mexico is
right.
A much better option, although I don't blame you at all. And I can't, I mean, I couldn't be in any way critical or question because as I've said, trying and failing is a way to perpetuate a drive, is even more, you know, guaranteed to perpetuate a drive. But yeah, I mean, I have not been able to entirely get rid of that, and part of it is really just wanting to find out, like, is it possible to somehow do good work within this system that has inspired me so much, like,
right. Yeah,
but I mean, I don't know. I mean, all we've talked about today and what 16 Maps of Hell partly is what it's attempting to do is to put on the Ray-Ban spectacles or pull back the veil, you know, and just see more honestly and nakedly the nature of the bargain that I think we take even or make even to imbibe the stuff, never mind to create it.
Right. Yeah. One thing I definitely wanted to touch on was, I think an experience I had, and I mentioned to you over email, that I think is definitely, certainly a microcosm of, or maybe it's more of like, it's a metaphor almost for really the darkness that lies underneath the industry. Like I said, I encountered this man, on a set once, and I began working for him. And like I said, this guy,
married to daughter of famous horror director,
and he was a CIA operative, 100%. He had been initiated into the CIA in the 80s. I think his uncle was involved. It's kind of hard to figure out, but he had mentioned some things to me. He worked at the time that I was working for him for this security company, intelligence company called Diligence, which is owned by this famous CIA agent named Mike Baker, who, if you read articles about him, works as a consultant to Hollywood. Right, you can't find any movies he's worked on, right, on IMDb. Mm-hmm. But so we wonder what kind of consulting he's actually doing or what he's actually doing there. But you can see the threads between them. And this guy, his name is Mike, practically homeless. He was like living with this like older woman. You know, his name wasn't on the lease, but he had like kind of tricked her into letting him live with her. Always had money to pay me. I was writing screenplays for him. He was very mentally ill. He was like a drug addict. But he had in his phone, he called up, you know the producer Bill Fay?
Producer of?
He was the head of Dimension Pictures. He produced like Dark Knight, The Hangover, like that big time producer, like, you know, could make your life in a second. Called him up and then just got him on the phone. He was really good friends with Al Ruddy.
Right.
And he told me a story about Al Ruddy, how when they made The Godfather, they had to screen The Godfather for all of the mafia bosses before it was released. They had to approve it.
Wow. Wow.
So he was there. Al Ruddy had been there. Obviously, he was the producer of The Godfather, obviously. And had been there at the screening, and he said, it's kind of a funny story, but it's interesting and dark, certainly, how these mafioso didn't understand the proper etiquette, I suppose, of this thing. So they had tipped the projector boy, whatever random like guy that worked in the theater, the projector boy, like hundreds and hundreds of dollars. They thought it was like a normal thing to be tipping these people, but that was the level of like connection this guy had. Like Al Ruddy was at his 50th birthday party. Like one of the most like, you know, legendary producers, certainly. I had videos of him on his phone. Famous musicians he had on the line, you know, famous music producers, financiers. He was involved in this space company with this famous like space guy. He was involved in a virtual reality company that was partially owned by Steven Spielberg and Kobe Bryant and this Chinese financier who was one of Michael Bay's financiers. I personally knew that guy, the Chinese financier. He was incredibly dark. He was addicted to drugs. I saw him getting into fist fights while I was working for him. He was like, had this very weird relationship with me where he was like in love with me and obsessed with me. And it's sort of a long-winded story. But I just found he was almost like a representation of this darkness lurking underneath the surface of Hollywood. These are the kind of people, this sort of perverted, drug addicted, lecherous sort of man who knew all these powerful people, knew all where all these bodies were buried, and had been in the CIA and had been to the parties and had been to the screen, you know, the premiere of Scream 2. Imagine the kind of shit, you know what I mean, that goes on there. I just thought it was something interesting to just talk about, like his, and he had been in this coma, this very mysterious coma, and had sort of gone insane after it. And I'll have to send you some of like the texts. He would like write me these texts that sounded like they're written by William Burroughs about insane things involving like mind control and sex and CIA. I mean, I'll have to screenshot them and send them to you because they're quite insane. But I just thought that was an interesting experience I had.
It definitely sounds like it. It sounds like a cliffhanger to end on as well. I guess we can talk about an email, but whether there's enough to really go into for a podcast. But I would agree that that sounds like a tip of an iceberg.
Right.
That's my approach. It's probably the only approach that works really with 16 Maps of Hell is just to look for I guess fractures in the facade and then just try and go through them. So specific case studies and, you know, to see them as blood samples of the system that will actually show the kind of pathology that's running through it. And this guy certainly sounds like that. So Yeah, perhaps we could talk about him on another occasion. Also, the thing about The Godfather, I think, is a great encapsulation of the point I was making earlier about, you know, if we even pick our favourite movie out of Hollywood, I mean, can we really be sure that it's so great? And Godfather's certainly up there in my top five. But, you know, if all the heads of mafia approved it, what does that say about my taste? I mean, is there something I'm not seeing? My God, you know, there's supposed to be this searing denunciation of the pathology of American society and the mafia and all that. But no, it got the big stamp of approval from, you know, from the very criminals that it was exposing.
Right. And yeah, this is like the five families, you know, 1970s. I mean, these are like the players, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I've had, you know, I know we're going to wrap up soon, but I've had many encounters with the mafia in my time working. Just one quick other anecdote. In this past fall, actually, I was connected via producer that I knew to this. Basically, he's the son of a famous mafia boss from Massachusetts. His name was, the father was Adolfo Bruno, Al Bruno. The son's name's Victor. Hmm. And the father had been assassinated by the mafia, you know, obviously. I mean, a hit had been taken out of him. He'd been killed. And the son wanted a screenplay written about this that happened. And his story was, and I went up to Springfield, Massachusetts to meet with him. He bought me an amazing dinner at his restaurant, got me a hotel room. You know, I'm very anti-strip club. I've never been to a strip club other than this experience. He took me to this huge strip club, introduced me to the man, and he just showed me the town, whatever. And his story was that actually what had happened was it was a conspiracy. The FBI had conspired with the mafia to put a hit out on his father. And I'm sure his father was no fucking Girl Scout. But that was a story, and he had laid out a significant amount of evidence for it, including the involvement of Robert Mueller, who was the head of like the Boston FBI at the time. Like Whitey Bulger was involved, all this stuff. And while I was there, he had this thing going on where there was somebody trying to buy, you know, he owned all these buildings in downtown Springfield. Somebody was trying to buy all of them, his businesses, his buildings. It was this young kid, you know, in his 20s, who had found some fortune on the internet and wanted to buy his buildings. And he had proof of funds. He had all these different things, but it was just something off about it. He was like, you know, talking to me, he was like, what do you think of this guy? There's something wrong about it. I don't know. Why the hell does this kid want to buy, you know, property here? Why? Didn't figure it out, whatever. We met, shook hands, you know, said we would talk later. 2 weeks later, the FBI raided his restaurant that I had eaten at 2 weeks prior and that strip club he had brought me to, shut down all his business, and I never heard from him again. That person trying to buy his businesses was like a honeypot operation of some kind, I don't know. But that's just one example of multiple other ones of me coming into direct contact with the mafia from my working in the industry. I thought that was, you know, a useful anecdote, but yeah, it's very heavily connected to that, certainly.
Changes in the heart, change with the times, strangers in the night, as up and down.
The end of this week's The Liminalist. On the last stretch for 60 Maps of Hell, we're just $50 away from the £8,880 target for the hardback. And all additional funds then that I raise will go towards expanding the hardback edition, and I guess the paperback too. Well, we'll see. Next week's podcast is with JC, or formerly known as Jizz, a Devashana participant, on his experiences entering into the ET field.
Changes in the heart, change with the time. Strangers in the night pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Changes in the heart, change with the times. in the heart. Stay up until